This is Shared State. I'm Nick Mott. This season, we have stories about Montanans navigating sticky political conflicts. Our story today is about allies figuring out just how far that allyship can go. It comes from Aaron Bolton, reporter at Montana Public Radio.
No? What's the dog's name?
Turbo.
Turbo.
Where exactly did you record this tape?
I recorded this as I was hiking into the Bandertu Medicine, which is this really important 130,000-acre piece of the Lewis and Clark National Forest. It connects Glacier National Park, that's to the north, and then the Bob Marshall Wilderness is to the south. But it's also on the western edge of the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. It's really important to the tribe for a lot of reasons, including that it used to be owned by the Blackfeet tribe, or Pekani. It's also the source of many of their origin stories.
We'll hike in here a little ways.
Okay.
We'll go up into this canyon.
And who's this guy you're out hiking with?
I'm hiking in with Tyson Running Wolf. He's currently a state lawmaker from Browning. He's a former Blackfeet Tribal Business Councilman, but he's also this member of this group called the Pekani Traditionalist Association, which is this group of Blackfeet elders. It's super easy to see Tyson's personal connection to the badger. You know, as we're going along, he points out this really crazy shot he had a few years back during deer hunting season.
And he went right through that gap, that little rock gap up there. I just had that one shot.
I mean, like I mentioned before, this land is culturally and spiritually just extremely important to the Blackfeet tribe. One of the particular stories he told me is about this mountain that's named Feather Woman.
Feather Woman is actually the true name of the mountain.
And it's based on this story where this woman, who is named Feather Woman,
she made a pledge to a star called Morning Star. Said, I'm going to marry that star. It was early in the morning. This guy was standing there. It was all white buckskin, braided hair. And he said, you made a pledge that you were going to marry me. Mom, come here.
As Tyson tells this story, Feather Woman goes to live among what he calls the Sky People. But eventually, she sees her family living back on Earth.
She just was broken-hearted, lonesome for them. And she went back down. Prior to her going down, though, she was given a whole bunch of gifts from the sun and the moon and the morning star.
And as Tyson explains it, these are all components of what he calls the Sun Lodge.
And so for time immemorial, since she's been back, we've practiced that ceremony every summer of a holy woman that comes and makes a pledge to put the Sun Lodge up. And then the community comes together and builds it for her, for the betterment of the people.
That's what that mountain's named after. It strikes me that Tyson's relationship with this whole landscape is just so intimate. It sounds like that's from his personal experience here, but also just what it means to the tribe.
Yeah, I mean, to Tyson and other tribal traditionalists, the Bandertu Medicine is one of the last places they have to practice ceremonies like these that are tied directly into the landscape itself. But in the last 40 years, that spiritual connection has been threatened by something that has attracted a lot of media attention and political interest, and that was the possibility of oil and gas development on these lands. And so far, that development hasn't turned into an actual reality, largely because of this alliance between the Blackfeet Nation, tribal traditionalists, and conservation groups.
In our last episode, we heard a story about collaborative conservation, the idea that everybody can give up a little to preserve the whole. Today, we have another story about allies working to preserve something and then finding their limits.
What happens when two groups working so hard to prevent oil and gas development in the Bandertu Medicine can't agree on how to protect the land for generations to come?
Aaron, where does this story start?
The Bandertu Medicine has been this really contentious place for over 100 years, but the story of this allyship, it all starts in Browning and East Glacier in the early 1980s.
The town was just taken over by helicopters that were going into the Badger and seismographing there.
This is Lou Bruno. He's a non-tribal conservationist who learned about oil and gas interests in the Bandertu Medicine when he saw these helicopters flying exploration crews into the area. After the summer of seismic exploration for oil goes on, Lou gets word that there's this meeting put on by the U.S. Forest Service in East Glacier to talk about the first company that wanted to drill in the Badger And this meeting was at the community hall in town.
There were a lot of people there. And the tension got really, really thick. You know, you could cut it with a knife.
They find out that there's 50 leases covering the Badger 2 Medicine, threatening this really pristine wildlife habitat. And that really kicks off a ton of community organizing. So Lou, other conservationists and locals, they form this group called the Glacier 2 Medicine Alliance to fight these leases. Blackfeet tribal traditionalists, for the same reasons, they form their own group called the Piikani Traditionalist Association. And these two groups, they really start working together. They file administrative appeals to stop the leases. The traditionalists also start taking oil executives into the Badger, trying to get them to understand its spiritual importance. Here's Curly Bear Wagner, a cultural leader, talking about some of those hikes in a documentary called Backbone of the World.
You start walking all over and walking this way, walking that way, walking over this way. So what you looking for? Well, I'm looking for your church. Where's your church at? You know, you say this is a spiritual area. Where's your church? And they said, well, you're standing in the middle of our pew. This is our church. And so things like that.
So we have these two different groups, conservationists and Blackfeet tribal members, with the same goal. They want to stop oil and gas development, and they start working together to do it. Does that initiative get any traction?
Yeah, drilling gets delayed one way or another. Eventually, in 2006, they got this bill through Congress that withdrew the Rocky Mountain Front, including the Badger, from future oil and gas leasing. But the bill was also this watershed moment for getting rid of existing leases, because there were financial incentives for oil and gas companies to give them up, and many of them did.
Our creator.
Blackfeet leaders like the late Chief Earl Oldperson were even invited to Washington, D.C. by top U.S. government officials for a celebratory ceremony.
We are continuing doing the best that we can to find ways and means to help our people.
So some companies gave up their leases, but not everybody.
There were some that didn't. One company in particular, called Solenex, actually sued over the various ways its lease had been put on hold for decades. That happened in 2013. Several conservation groups, the Piikani Traditionalist Association, all together get involved in that case. And as that case is heating up, there's another effort to block drilling, led by a guy named John Murray.
Aaron. Yeah, nice to meet you.
John Murray is the Blackfeet Historic Tribal Preservation Officer and is also the current head of the Piikani Traditionalist Association. For years, John and others have been using the tribe's oral stories to argue that even one oil and gas well would diminish the tribe's spiritual connection to the Badger 2 Medicine.
Basically saying that, you know, this we've always been here. We've had occupation in this area for a long, long time.
As the leases were still on hold in the 1990s, the federal government did conduct what's called an ethnography, which basically documented the Blackfeet's spiritual connection to the land. That led to a small piece of the Badger being declared something called a traditional cultural district. That means the federal government would have to consider how actions like oil drilling impact that cultural district. But the district boundary didn't include many oil and gas leases. John felt like the whole thing really missed the mark.
This is not right. We didn't think these ethnographies were adequate.
So John gets a grant to do another ethnography. And in 2014, his ethnography is cited as the reason to expand the traditional cultural district to include all of the Badger. And his main point, that even one well harms the tribe's spiritual connection to the land, that point is one of the main reasons why then-Democratic Interior Secretary Sally Jewell cancels the Solenex lease a couple of years later.
So the ethnography then gave us footing to be recognized in their world.
More companies had given up their leases, and by early 2017, the Badger, for the first time since the 1980s, was oil and gas free. Solenex is still fighting this in court. Blackfeet leaders and traditionalists and conservation groups, they all decide they need to make a push for permanent protection through federal legislation. but finding a type of legal protection that meets both conservation and tribal interests, that proves to be a really difficult task.
More on that search for how to protect the badger after the break.
Hey, this is Sally Mock, host of Campaign Beat, Montana Public Radio's weekly political analysis program. Campaigns for the 2022 midterms are underway. For the first time in decades, Montanans will send two representatives to the U.S. House. We'll bring you the context behind the headlines every week on Campaign Beat. Tune in Saturday mornings at 9:45 or listen to the show on your schedule wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Shared State. I'm Nick Mott. Reporter Aaron Bolton has been talking about how Blackfeet cultural traditionalists, tribal council leaders, and environmental conservationists worked hand-in-hand against oil and gas development in the Badger II Medicine for 30 years. Now that the Badger is free of active oil and gas leases, they've turned their attention to permanently protecting the land. But what exactly should be protected? And how? And who gets to decide? Aaron, that sounds almost as messy as that fight that brought them together in the first place.
Yeah, they're still largely on the same page about protection that would shut the door on new oil and gas development. But there's a history of Blackfeet treaty rights that make this complicated. Tyson Running Wolf, who took me on a hike in the Badger, says Blackfeet leaders were leery of attempts in Congress in the 80s and 90s because the tribe had already lost treaty rights in what's now the east side of Glacier National Park when the park was formed. Blackfeet members still have those same rights in the Badger to hunt, fish, and gather timber, and don't want to lose them.
Any new designation, we're like, another ploy to try to eventually screw us out of the little we have now.
Finding the right designation to both protect the land and ease fears about losing treaty rights was really hard to do. For example, then Republican Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke actually suggested that the Badger become a national monument in 2017.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke will recommend the Badger II Medicine be given protection as a national monument. That announcement comes.
So making the Badger a national monument could add protections, but it could also impact treaty rights. And can't national monuments also be downsized? Like, that's what the Trump administration did with bear's ears in Utah, right?
Totally. Conservation groups and tribal leaders all agreed a national monument wasn't the right fit. Peter Metcalf with the Glacier II Medicine Alliance says they all agreed that they had to carve their own path and write their own bill.
We needed to come up with something that fit the unique values of this landscape, you know, that honored treaty rights and honored the long history of the Blackfeet, and at the same time recognized the landscape's importance for other people, and that tried to move the needle forward in a way that there would be better cooperation and management of that area.
That bill was called the Badger II Medicine Protection Act.
What's so special about this particular conservation bill?
Peter says the Badger II Medicine Protection Act would obviously ban all oil and gas development, but it would also accomplish a lot of run-of-the-mill conservation ideas.
In some ways, it was really conservative because it really froze in the status quo in terms of what's happening on the landscape right now around motorized and road building and timber harvest and stuff.
The bill would also give the Blackfeet Nation a say in how the federal government managed the Badger, including the ability to say no to new projects and land use proposals. Everyone involved tells me this bill was really on the cutting edge of land use designation. And then in 2020, Montana's Democratic U.S. Senator John Tester actually introduces the bill in Congress.
This is a time when the government is so divided, so partisan. What were this bill's chances?
At the time, people like Peter Metcalf were feeling really good about the Protection Act's odds of actually passing, because as it got into December, near the end of the Trump administration, all these small bills that would struggle to pass on their own are riding on the coattails of a monster must-pass budget bill. But the Badger II Medicine Protection Act never made it in, meaning it was technically dead.
So all these local players seem to be on the same page to get this done, but it dies at the federal level. Can't they just try again with all that support on the ground?
They could, but the Tribal Business Council also had an election and a change in leaders. This new business council, they pulled support for the bill. that took conservationists like Michael Jameson with the National Parks Conservation Association by surprise.
We all knew all along the way that that original bill was going to have to change, that they would have lots of tweaks along the way. We did not know that they would rescind support for it fully at some point in the future. No one did. It was a whole different council.
So why did that council support break down?
There were a lot of reasons, but a big one was a communication breakdown between the conservation groups and this new council. The council had some particular issues with the language in the bill. But the more they thought about what they wanted out of that legislation, the more they came back to this idea of getting this land that had once been a part of the reservation back entirely from the federal government.
So switching from this, you know, Federal Congressional Protection Act to asking for land back entirely is a pretty big pivot. How and why did the tribal council switch directions?
That switch in direction all starts with one person named Joe McKay.
Well, let's visit for a minute and see where we're talking about.
He is, to some, a controversial figure. He's a tribal member who's a lawyer. He led an unsuccessful push to rewrite the Blackfeet Nation's constitution. And at one point, tribal officials tried to bar him from practicing law on the reservation. But he's one of the people who convinced this new Blackfeet Tribal Council that the Badger to Medicine Protection Act was not the path forward.
Because it is a sellout, a denigration of the rights of my ancestors and their sacrifices to reserve those resources for me and for all of our children to come.
There are a lot of layers to why Joe is against the bill. On a practical level, he thinks it would conflict with the tribe's treaty rights in the Badger, though there's some legal disagreement on that point. He also takes issue with conservation groups' involvement in trying to get some kind of protection status for the land.
I view non-Indian environmentalists' interest in these areas and in the reservation as being, in my view, in the same nature as colonization. And that is because they elevate their own interests and concerns over the interests of my people.
He says the tribe's connection to the land is more important than any other interest. And that's why he sees getting the land returned to the tribe as the only path forward.
If it were up to me, just me alone, I would create a protection for it. I would designate it a protected area. But 20 years from now, a new generation were to say, geez, things haven't got better. We need to do something to help our people. And that they decided that they needed to develop somehow those resources. In my mind, that's their call. That's their choice.
So Joe is all about sovereignty. The Badger II medicine should belong to the tribe, and the tribe alone should decide what happens on that land. How widespread is that idea?
There is larger support for this idea of the tribe deciding how the Badger II medicine is managed if it were to get the land back. The core of that argument stems from the late 1800s, when the Badger and parts of what's now the east side of Glacier National Park were still a part of the Blackfeet Nation's reservation. Both pieces of land together are called the Ceded Strip.
You know, we talk about oral history and how it was handed down to my family.
This is Lauren Monroe. He's the tribal council secretary. He says the story about how the tribe actually came to sell this land depends on who's telling it.
There's a lot of older people that feel that, you know, it was stolen from us, just legitimately stolen.
So in the late 1800s, the federal government had interests in the Ceded Strip because they thought there was gold and copper and silver in the land. Recorded history says the government offered to buy the strip from the tribe for $1.5 million. But Lauren says the government already wasn't living up to past treaty agreements.
We were supposed to be getting government rations, and it wasn't happening. They were often rotted, and people were starving to death, and we lost over 600 members.
Lauren says annual payments stemming from previous land deals were also due to end. At the same time, another campaign from the federal government had killed off most of the Blackfeet's major food source, which was bison. So with little money and no food, Lauren says Blackfeet leaders at the time felt they had little choice but to agree to sell the ceded strip.
Yeah, it was made under duress, you know. It wasn't their first choice. You know, they wouldn't have done it. I know that.
So what started as a fairly narrow conversation about oil and gas development on one chunk of land has evolved into this much bigger conversation about, as people like Lauren see it, righting historical wrongs. Has total return of land like this ever happened before? Is what the tribal council is asking for here even possible?
Yeah, it's actually happened pretty recently.
The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe and the Chippewa National Forest have come.
In December of 2020, the Chippewa National Forest in Minnesota returned 11,000 acres it had wrongfully taken from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. In 2016, a handful of tribes in Nevada were able to get Congress to pass a bill returning 71,000 acres of public land. But return is not always the case. The federal government has tried to find other ways to settle. The most notable is a 40-year-old court settlement for the illegal taking of the Black Hills in South Dakota from the Sioux Nation.
That we want Mount Rushmore closed and the return of that land back to the indigenous people.
The tribes that make up that nation haven't taken this settlement, which is now worth over $1 billion. Instead, they continue to push for full return of the land through legislation. All of these are pieces of a social movement called Land Back. Crystal Tubols is the Land Back campaign manager for Indian Collective, which is this nonprofit that is a leader of this social movement and organizes protests like these.
For us, reclaiming land and land back also means reclaiming everything stolen from us when we were forcibly removed from the land. And that means reclaiming language and ceremony and culture and our identities.
Think healthcare, health outcomes, job opportunities, you name it. She says all of this stems back to Native Americans being forcibly removed from the land by the federal government. So reclaiming lands is reclaiming what they had before first contact by Europeans. Crystal says there is a spectrum of what land back can look like. With private land, it can mean tribal nations buying land back or people gifting land back to tribes. When it comes to federally owned and public lands, there's also co-management between tribal nations and the federal government.
Co-management is definitely a valid way of reclaiming land and of land back. But for us, we only support co-management if it is part of a longer strategy to fully reclaim those lands.
So while there is this spectrum to Crystal, it should be all leading to one place, and that's actual return of the land to tribes.
So is this social movement actually getting the kind of traction that people like Crystal are hoping for?
To Crystal, it is. On one hand, the main way tribes can get land returned is through federal legislation, and getting things through Congress can be really, really hard. But there are some recent developments that make Crystal hopeful, like having Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first indigenous person in that position, leading some of these key federal agencies. Crystal thinks that makes the Biden administration more likely to support specific legislation.
With all of the different indigenous peoples that have been placed within, you know, USDA, within Department of Interior, we're in a very unique place where we actually can push really hard right now and reclaim these lands.
But law professor Monty Mills at the University of Montana says there are still plenty of barriers, even with a potentially sympathetic Biden administration.
Tribes asserting claims to return those properties to the tribes and to their original owners can present some real challenging political determinations for Congress and for others who may see the interests that have developed in public lands as too important to be disturbed.
Tell me a little more about those interests in public lands.
Monty means public lands are a really, really big deal, especially in the West. Businesses like outfitters, guiding services, equipment retailers, they all rely on access to these public lands. Counties with big areas of federally owned land, they get payments from the federal government, so there's also public funding at stake. Monty and Crystal also say some public land users are afraid that tribes will limit access or mismanage the land. All of those interests pose real hurdles to any land back push. And Monty says the Badger 2 Medicine is no exception.
It sounds like there might be this kind of intractable conflict between land back, at least when we're talking about public land, and public lands focused conservation groups. Do you see these two interests as in any way reconcilable?
People like Crystal say they can be at odds, but they don't have to be. She says the fear that tribal nations will completely cut off access or mismanage lands are just unfounded. Structuring return of lands around public interest because of those fears, she says, is an extension of colonization.
We're done being told how to manage our own lands and how to be on our own lands and be in relationship to our own lands. That era is done with. We're moving into an era of truly leaning into reparations and leaning into repair and leaning into demanding what is just and what is right.
How are conservation groups here in Montana feeling about a land back push happening with the Badger 2 Medicine?
So far, Blackfeet political leaders say they have been talking to the federal government about what this could actually look like. But those talks have been behind closed doors. Conservation groups say they haven't been involved. I asked Peter Metcalf with the Glacier 2 Medicine Alliance what he wants to see. He says the Blackfeet's connection to this place, it really does need to be protected. But he adds the tribe needs to work out what land return would actually look like with the federal government.
And then the federal government has to decide, you know, is this in the national interest? Is this something that serves the national interest to do? And that's true with any of these sorts of shifts in management arrangements.
So on one hand, we have the Blackfeet Nation making this very concerted push to get the land back. And on the other, we have conservation groups saying the American public needs a say in how this land is managed. Where do we go from here?
As of now, that's a bit unclear. The two sides aren't really talking. Lauren Monroe with the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council says the tribe would welcome support from conservation groups, but says whatever happens, the tribe needs to take the lead.
I think the future is that we will continue to manage our own territory and be involved with decision-making and continue leading and making decisions that will benefit us as Blackfeet people versus someone else, which has always been throughout history for Blackfeet. We had to accept what was decided for us. Going forward, maybe Indian people, Blackfeet, can make their decisions and make their own destiny.
Despite the holding pattern on the future of the Badger 2 Medicine, Blackfeet political and traditionalist leaders, as well as conservation groups, they say they will continue to engage where there are shared interests. And for now, that remains what brought them together in the first place, the ongoing fight to rid the Badger of the last remaining oil and gas lease owned by Solenex, as that court case is still ongoing.
Shared State is a production from Montana Free Press, Montana Public Radio, and Yellowstone Public Radio. This episode was reported by Aaron Bolton, edited by Nikki Ouellette, and produced by Mara Silvers. I'm your host, Nick Mott. Editorial assistance from Corin Cates Carney, Brad Tyer, and Nadia Foe. Fact-checking by Jess Sheldahl, and our sound designer is Gabe Sweeney.